Today's Taisho will be on Case 88 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 88 is entitled Gensha's Man of Three Disabilities. Engo's Introduction. In his teaching, the master often turns two into three. Talking of the profound, he goes through and through it, seven times piercing and eight times breaking through. He adapts himself to all circumstances, penetrates the most mysterious secrets. Acting on the principles of the Buddha, he leaves no trace of his actions. Where do the complicated koans come from? If you have an eye to see, see the following. Main subject, Gensha said to the assembly, every teacher in the land talks of saving things and delivering humankind. When a man of the three disabilities comes to you, how do you deal with him? A blind man does not see you holding up the hosu. A deaf person does not hear your words. A dumb person will not talk even if you want him to. How do you approach him? If you cannot, Buddhism can bestow no benefit. A monk asked Umon about this topic. Umon said, make your bows. The monk did so. Umon made as if to push the monk with his staff. The monk retreated. Umon said, you are not blind. He then said, come close to me. The monk approached Umon, who said, you are not deaf. Umon asked the monk, do you understand? The monk replied, no, I do not understand. Umon said, you are not dumb. The monk attained an insight. Blind, deaf, and dumb, none could come near. Throughout the country, none could understand. Riro did not discern the true color, nor Shiko the subtle sound. Let us sit quietly by the window and enjoy the falling leaves, the spring flowers. I say, do you understand? It is a holeless iron hammer. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. And I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job. Some of you have been here since sutra recitation early this morning and sitting so still, so well. That's really the secret. It's the secret. Thank you so much for doing such an excellent job. And for those of you who have come later, thank you also for your excellent sitting today. So this case, I don't think I need to read it a second time. Gensha's Person of Three Disabilities. And the question seems to be about how a great Zen master can communicate the Dharma to somebody who is blind, to somebody who is deaf, and somebody who cannot speak. Okay, so that's the ostensible question at the heart of the koan, but of course, that's not the real question, right? So, I spent some of July with my wife's family helping my sister-in-law to move out of her condo. And I actually was in the condo sometimes when I was joining the sits from New Mexico. I think I mentioned that there was a lot of work involved in getting that place ready to be put up for sale and getting my sister-in-law ready to move in with her other sister. It's a big place. It has two bedrooms and a big main room and a kitchen, and that doesn't sound very big, but you know, it's formidable actually. It took a lot of work. And my sister-in-law has been living there for, I guess, 15 or 16 years since her father passed away. It was originally his condo. And in that time, you know, my sister-in-law had developed COPD, and gradually that took a toll on her heart. So, you know, the last time she was here in New Mexico staying with us many years ago, she was able to walk from, Penn Station all the way up to the Met Museum. And, you know, a couple times we would get off the train, walk up to the Met Museum through Central Park on a glorious fall day, as I recall. And then we'd go to the museum and we'd walk around the museum. And of course, one of my favorite places to be is in the Asian collection at the Met, which is a stunningly good collection, really breathtaking. Many beautiful and probably stolen items are in that collection. Anyway, it's always a joy for me to be there. And it was, my sister-in-law is an artist. She's a painter mostly and a ceramicist, right? She makes beautiful ceramics. And really her métier is watercolor, you know, and she's an amazing watercolorist. You know? Later on today, I'll put on Facebook one of her watercolors. It's really just beautiful. So anyway, she and I and my wife went to the Met one day in the fall many years ago, and we had a wonderful day, you know, and we had a little snack at the Met, and then we walked back. We walked all the way back down through by the New York Public Library, another lovely park, and I love that building, and then we walked to Penn Station again and got on the train and went home. And my sister-in-law thought nothing of doing that. You know, that's not a lot of miles, but it's significant, right? Especially when you put in the walking in the museum. So now, you know, now it's very difficult for her to walk across the room. And she, her COPD has been, you know, a factor in her life for almost 20 years now, for about 15 or 16 years. And it's taken a toll on her pulmonary system, right? And I mentioned that she had to have open heart surgery this about a year ago. So it's quite a shock to see somebody who could, you know, get off the train and walk to the Met and walk back, have to have a walker to get across the room. And breathing very heavily, right? You know, like you can hear, you know, quite audible, even for those of us who don't have great hearing, you know, to be able to hear her puffing and huffing and puffing, right? And she gets to the end of the room and she has to sit down. So, you know, that's a situation none of us really want to be in, right? And you know, being with my sister-in-law for a couple of weeks was eye-opening because, you know, I'm an able-bodied person, as they say. You know, I park my car, and if I have to park a few blocks away from where I'm going, I just walk. You know, if it's a nice day, great. If it's not, great. I don't have to think about whether I can make it or not, right? And I don't have to think about the issue of mobility once I get there. So, you know, at one time, we took a break from all our hard work and we went to a lovely restaurant called the Satellite Cafe. It's a great place, wonderful food. They have vegan menu and vegetarian menu and other and regular, you know, meat eating, dairy, that kind of thing. So it's a wonderful restaurant. It's out, and you know, you can eat outside. They have a beautiful, the inside is enclosed in glass and it's beautiful visibility and they've done lovely gardening. And then you can sit outside and half the outside space is like an adobe wall that's painted crimson. Right, beautiful crimson, and there's this green bamboo in front of it, and there's a big cottonwood and Siberian elms overhead. So it's just quite beautiful. But you know, it's not easy for somebody who's mobility impaired to get into that space. And it was a big production to get my sister-in-law in there. And I realized, you know, how challenging, you know, you had to really plot it out. You had to really think about how to get her in and out of that space. And, you know, she has a walker that you can actually fold up and put in the car. It's really nice. And you can unfold it. And if you have to, you can fold it and walk through a door and then unfold it and so on. So it's perfect for this. It's pretty well designed for mobility, but lots of buildings aren't well designed. It's funny that my sister-in-law has COPD, although she was a smoker, because her father, my father-in-law, had COPD also, and he was also a smoker. And he died from the complications caused by his smoking. And my father-in-law was a design engineer. After World War II, he got a job working for Los Alamos, where Robert Oppenheimer was running the Manhattan Project. And my father-in-law, Jack, was basically had engineering training and artistic training. His brother became a rather well-known sculptor, and so Jack was involved in the design aspects of the atom bomb. Believe it or not, he actually designed the Fat Man and Little Boy bombs. I don't know if that's something to be proud of, but he was on the team that put those together, the design engineers. They didn't come up with the technology, but they put the technology in a container. So anyway, my father-in-law was a smoker, and he was somebody who loved the outside, loved the outdoors, and he liked to sail. That was his big, he lived in New Mexico, but he would sail around Lake Powell in his sailboat. But, you know, as he got older, he too had all these issues. You know, one time we were driving around, you always have to have your tank of oxygen, right? You know, so, you know, now they have portable compressors that will compress the oxygen for you. But in the old days, my father-in-law always used to have tanks of oxygen that he would take with him. And you have to know each tank is like 45 minutes, so you have to count your tanks. And I remember at one point my father-in-law came to live with us because he couldn't live by himself. And we took him to the Met. And at that time we had gotten for my father-in-law a little battery-powered cart. It's like a little golf cart, only it's very portable. You can put it in the back of your car. And it has a pretty long-lived battery. And it worked really well, and so we drove into New York, into Manhattan, and I paid like $100 to park my car for the day. You know, it might have been more. And we took out this little vehicle, which was called the Rascal, right? The Rascal. And my father-in-law rode in his little electric vehicle into the Met, and I had called, and they allowed him to come in. So, you know, before he died, about 8 years before he died, he had a chance to go around the Met and look at all this glorious art. And some of the galleries are not accessible. I had to, you know, basically carry him up the stairs and then carry the Rascal up the stairs. But he had a lovely day. But, you know, when this happens to us, it's something none of us want to deal with, right? I mean, I'm, you know, pride myself on being in good physical shape. I work out on an elliptical machine, and I run or walk probably like 15 miles a week, just walking and running. And you know, when I was taking care of my father-in-law, it was just such a wrenching experience, you know. And, you know, it made me think, oh, I hope this never happens to me, right? But of course, you know, we know in a certain way it's going to happen to us. But, you know, that's not really what this koan is about, you know, so much, right? You know, although the koan is partly about this, disabilities, right? So, you know, if you sit with this koan and you say, and you happen to be me, and you say disabilities, you start thinking of all the people you know who have had or have disabilities, you know. My mother was also very athletic, and when she was about 50 years old, she had a lupus flare-up and almost died, and she couldn't open a door. She couldn't open a can, right? She couldn't, like, open a jar, right? You know, that was far beyond her abilities. And, you know, when that happens to us, we say, oh, what a misfortune, you know, how terrible. Let's hope that never happens to us, right? And, of course, we know somewhere in our minds that we're going to get old and it's going to be difficult someday to open a can, right? If it's not already, it's going to be difficult. If it's not already hard to get upstairs, it's going to be difficult. So part of the koan is just about disabilities, right? Disabilities. But I also think it's asking us to explore that feeling we have of, like, control, you know. So when I was young, early in my college years, I had a lot of problems with stress. You know, I was taking calculus, that was hard. I was taking advanced French, that was very difficult, you know. You weren't allowed to speak English in the class, that was hard, right, you know. And, you know, a lot of the reading material was challenging. We were, reading people like Camus and Gide in the original, and that was challenging, you know. So I had a lot of stress, and I started jogging. And, you know, jogging was very good for cutting stress, but it also gave me this feeling of, like, power. Being a powerful person, right? Because I was a nerd and I was sort of a wimp. So when I began to run and I began to get really fast and get into good shape, it was a little intoxicating, you know. I actually used to go to the gym and I used to start doing a little weightlifting. And weightlifting for me was quite a new experience. I had never lifted weights. And actually, I am not one of these people who can put on a lot of bulk. So when I lifted weights, I got stronger, but I didn't, you know, get muscular. And around that same time, I had a summer job. After my first year of college, I had to go to work and make some money. And I took a construction job, which, you know, was something I didn't even understand what a construction job was, right? But I actually worked on a construction site where they were building homes, and I was a person who had, you know, I was the valedictorian of my high school class, but I hadn't ever spent a day shoveling dirt, right, or digging with a pick, you know. It's like, oh my God. So, you know, I took this job because it was the highest paying job I could get, and I needed the money to stay in school. And I made a bundle of money, you know. At that time, I was making like $4 an hour, which in 1971 was a lot of money. Anyway, that summer I almost died, right? It was just so tough. And I would come home and I would just go straight to sleep. And I had something called blood blisters all over my hands. But, you know, at the end of the summer, I was so strong, right? It was just like I couldn't believe it. And I remember we had to lift these metal beams that went in the basement of these homes. They were I-beams, small metal I-beams. At the beginning of the summer, I could barely get through the day, you know, digging in the dirt for 8 hours. By the end, I could barely lift the shovel, you know. I actually used to go and hide because I just had no energy left. And by the end of the summer, one of my colleagues who was who hadn't gone to college, he was a laborer from Warrenton, Virginia. he and I picked up the steel beam together and put it up on these cement blocks. And he marveled. He said, "Oh my God, I can't believe you just did that." He said, "You know, when you were such a weakling when you came here." So it gave me this sense of power, you know, of being able to do things. I learned how to run. I got stronger. I lifted weights, and I had this sense that, you know, I could handle myself. And I think that's very healthy in a certain way, right? I think that's very healthy. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, I have known a lot of people who are like obsessively interested in like bodybuilding, right? You know, so there have been a number of people in the Zen group, actually, who have come into the Zen group and they've been sort of like normal human beings, you know. And then I'll see them like they get to be around 20 years old and then they start working out with weights, right? And I see them like bulking up, right? They start, they must be going to the gym, they must be drinking like protein shakes. And a couple times the transformation has been surprising and a little bit, almost like alarming. You know, they've gone from like looking like rather nice young men to looking like, you know, like action figures. And it's a little weird, right? I know people like that who just, you know, they actually like spend hours in the gym every day, bulking up. And in fact, my cousin was like that. My cousin was, my cousin Jeffrey grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, which is a very lovely place. And, you know, when he was in high school, he was bullied a lot because he was sort of studious and he began to lift weights. He actually became muscle bound. My aunt had to make him stop lifting weights. He couldn't actually scratch his back after a while, you know. So what's that about? And what does that have to do with Zen? Well, you know, I think these two things go together. You know, this experience of like powerlessness. You know, you're powerless. My father-in-law, I actually had to lift, he was pretty light. I had to lift him up and walk up the stairs with him in my arms when we went to the Met. He was an 85-year-old man. He had fought in World War II. He had been in the Battle of Anzio, you know, and I had to carry him up the stairs. And it was a pleasure, you know. He had a lot of joy that day. But that feeling of being so powerless, you know, that's a feeling we don't like. And, you know, my cousin, you know, getting bullied in high school, you know, and beefing up, becoming a muscle man, you know, that's like trying to avoid being helpless, you know, trying to be powerful, trying to be in charge and in control. And it's a totally human reaction. These are like totally human. They go together, right? Being powerless, and then the solution to being powerless is to be powerful. Right? Be powerless and powerful. And I also think that this drama sort of repeats itself in other ways, right? So, you know, a lot of people who are like super, super rich were poor, super, super poor when they were little kids, you know. And there's a fairly large percentage of people who, had food insecurity as children. You know, they're usually white and they had access to education and things like that. And, you know, as adults, they became, super motivated to become incredibly rich, right? Just like incredibly rich. So this experience of powerlessness and wanting to be powerful, I think, go together. And it's totally human, right? To respond to the experience of powerlessness by wanting to be powerful, right? So I just like to point out that, we learn a little bit different lesson in Zen, a little bit different lesson in Buddhism. So you know, when you start to do meditation, you know, one of the lessons you learn, I think, is that you can't, you know, power your way through it. You can't power your way through it. So when you sit down on the cushion and you are watching your breath, when you're first learning how to enter samadhi, you know, there's nothing you can do to make it happen, right? And you can't make it happen on your timetable, right? So you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you are watching your breath and you're trying to get away from your thoughts. And, you know, actually, you can't make them go away, right? And the more you try to make your thoughts go away, actually, the more painful and difficult your sit is likely to become, right? So probably the way you learned how to enter samadhi was just sitting on the cushion and gently coming back to your breath. And at some point, for reasons you might not even have been able to explain, right? You're able to find yourself, or you find yourself in samadhi. You just find yourself in samadhi. You notice all of a sudden that there's fewer thoughts, and you also feel this different, it's like that your head is empty a little bit, right? And, you know, usually when people are in that state, they don't ask themselves, how did I make this happen? You know, because actually you didn't make it happen. And the same thing happens in more advanced forms of meditation. So those of you who have come to Sesshin know that when you sit for 8 hours a day, you know, your legs start to hurt. You know, maybe it doesn't take 8 hours. Maybe it just takes an hour. But when you sit down on the cushion for 8 hours, you know, by the end of the first day, your legs are really tired, and it hurts. And, you know, you can try to power your way through. You know, you can try to fight the pain, but what's likely to happen is that you are unable to do that, you know? And so then you just wind up sitting in pain for long stretches of time. But you know, What eventually takes place is that you're sort of like awash in the pain, and you're watching, you're grabbing at your breath. And then all of a sudden, it's like there's a shift, there's a gestalt switch. And it's like the pain doesn't disappear, but it's as though you're in a different place, right? It's as though actually, you know, it's almost as though yourself has disappeared, right? This is a really deep experience of samadhi. It's like the pain is here, but the breath is at the center of your attention. And when you follow the breath out, it's like going to this place that's calm and empty, like the eye of a tornado, right? The wind is spinning around the tornado. That's your pain. But if you focus on the breath, it takes you to this place that's actually like sunny and serene. And maybe you're not able to get there 100%, but you're out of the whirlwind of your suffering, right? And now you're in this place that's still and serene, and a lot of practice takes place sort of moving between those two places. But you know, you don't make that happen. And one of the first lessons of Zen practice is that, you know, the way we respond to suffering is not to try to gain more control over the situation. See? And this is like a crucial lesson. We all, when we feel threatened or when we feel helpless, you know, the natural response is to try to increase our control over things, right? It's natural. So, you know, my cousin just got tired of getting pushed around at Montclair High School. I don't think that was a terribly tough school, but it must have been tough enough for him. So, you know, it makes sense that my cousin would try to bulk up. You know, but notice what you know, what that, how that effect that had on him, right? You know, that doesn't, that, that makes you like a little fortress, right? Makes you like a little walking fortress, you know? So, so now you're protected. You're protected by, you know, your muscles. You're protected by your, maybe your size now. You know, I think my cousin, when he started bulking up, he gained about 30 pounds, you know? He actually was on the, got on the wrestling team, you know? So, you know, my cousin transformed himself to be kind of like invulnerable. But, you know, actually that isolated him a lot. You know, it was interesting that my cousin's no longer with us, but in his later life, my cousin developed a drinking problem, which is an issue in my family in general. But, you know, I think part of his drinking problem came from his inability to have relationships with people, you know? And, you know, he was very like, he was like a little fortress, you know? And, you know, he wasn't able to respond to his feelings of helplessness or uncertainty or being out of control by going to that place where you start to connect. You start to connect, you know. I think what happens to us in Zazen is that when we feel out of control, we learn how to empty out. And when you empty out, you start connect. You actually start connecting with everything around you. People think of meditation as like a very isolated state. So if you don't know anything about meditation and you walk into a room like this and you look, you see all these people, we would say, who are in themselves. But actually, I don't think that's true. You know where I think people are like that? I think people are like that at the gym. That's what, really, they're all in themselves, right? They're in front of the mirror, and yoga studios too, right? Everybody's in front of the mirror, right? And they're all doing their thing, right? You know, before COVID, I would go to a gym too, right? So I'm not knocking gyms. But what I am calling attention to is that a lot of people respond to the feeling of powerlessness by trying to be powerful, And that there's another response to that, which is not to pursue, to become a little fortress, right? But to actually, you know, basically connect, dissolve and connect. So, you know, I think one of my cousin's problems was that he got very good at being like a little fortress. And he wasn't so good at emptying out and connecting. Or you could say, you know, when things are causing us suffering, you know, that's when, oddly, we most need to trust the situation. Trusting the situation is the hardest thing to do when things are causing us suffering, right? And so, you know, it's natural not to trust in situations that are causing us suffering. And it's, you know, when we don't trust, we want to become strong and gain control over the situation. But that isolates us, right? That cuts us off. And it doesn't solve our problem. You know, I went to elementary school in Baltimore, and, you know, just getting to school without getting beaten up was like a major achievement. So getting beaten up is a problem, right? But, you know, becoming somebody who can beat up others might not be the solution, right? It makes sense, but it's not the real solution. You know, it's better to learn how to empty out and connect with the world around us. You know, one of the greatest Zen masters of the 20th century was a Chinese, without a doubt, the greatest Zen master of the 20th century was a Chinese guy named Xu Yun. And Xu Yun was actually born around the time of the American Civil War, believe it or not. And he died in 1958, you know, And they have his birth records. It's not phony, you know. He lived, in other words, he lived to be like 112, 115 or something. So, Xu Yun's Dharma name was Empty Cloud, Empty Cloud. Yunmen, Umon, in this koan, his name is Yunmen, Cloud Gate, the Cloud Gate. See, to be a cloud is really like a very high level of accomplishment, right? You know how to empty out and connect. You know how to empty out and disperse, right? Empty out and disperse. To be like a cloud, you can be a muscle man, but nobody can punch a cloud, right? Nobody can grab a cloud. When we do zazen, we're in maybe on day two of sesshin, we're in an ocean of pain. Every sit, our legs hurt. And what we want to do is close up like a fist. You want to be like a fist. But actually that just intensifies your pain. So what you learn to do is learn to breathe through your pain. When you're in pain, you want to stop breathing. You want to clench up. And instead you learn to breathe through your pain. Deep breaths. And you breathe through the pain. And when you breathe through the pain dissolves. And the pain feels like a solid wall until you breathe through the pain, and then it dissolves. And then you do it again, and there's that pain, and you breathe through the pain, and it dissolves, and you're in that place, that eye of the tornado, which is motionless and bright, right? And then it comes back, but you keep doing this, and as you do this, you stop being the center of your consciousness. Now, this is what's so liberating about zazen, lots of hours of zazen. There's no substitute, right? You can read form as emptiness, but that's not the same as experience form as emptiness, right? And 2 days of zazen, and you begin to really, you breathe through the pain, and you begin to disappear. You really begin to disappear, and that's momentous, right? I mean, that's a really momentous condition. People do it the first time and it's kind of nice, at least it's a release from your suffering, but eventually you go outside and you notice that when you're in that state, everything feels intimate. So you walk outside after like the afternoon of day two of sesshin, and there's this feeling of intimacy with everything that's around you. It's like you have no clothes, it's like having no clothes on without the embarrassment, right? There's just nothing between you and the world. And everything is fresh and clean, and you're not self-referencing, right? It's like to be with the to see the grass is to be the grass. To hear the crow is to be the crow. To see the sky is to be the sky. This is a superior state, right? This is a form of enlightened mind, right? This is form as emptiness, and emptiness as form. And when we're in this state, one of the things Thich Nhat Hanh called this state interbeing. According to Buddhist teaching, nothing has own being. So we know in an abstract sense that a human being cannot exist without, say, oxygen. And oxygen can't exist without plants, right, to process the CO2 and turn it into oxygen, right? And there are all these chemical and biological processes that keep life on Earth going. And even though when we're in pain, our impulse is to be a fortress. We know that we're not a fortress. We're actually just part of this process. And, the way to get out of pain is not to recoil from the pain and bulk up. The way to get out of pain is to empty out and disperse. and allow yourself to participate in this larger process. You know, I was rereading, I'm teaching a course on the environment in the fall, and I was rereading Dorian Sagan's book, Microcosmos. Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan wrote this book. And, you know, one of the things they say is that if you look at a cell, you know, all the items in the cell used to be like freewheeling organisms in themselves. Right? They speculate on this, but this is their argument, that, you know, different parts of the cell all used to be, you know, 12 billion years ago, independent organisms, and that they bonded together and made a cell. What we call cell today was all of these independent organisms sort of allied themselves. They decided to team up and become a cell. And many of them still have these independent functions. You know, they're probably not aware that they're not independent organisms. You know, maybe they still think they are, you know. But, you know, we're like that too, right? I mean, we think we're independent organisms, and, you know, we feel very isolated and helpless at times. But, you know, the solution, we think the solution is to, you know, strengthen the walls, withdraw into ourselves. But, you know, actually, when you enter that state of interbeing, you know, it takes a couple days of meditation to get there, right? It takes a couple days because, you know, we keep recoiling back into ourselves. But, you know, every time that strategy fails, you know, it drives us, it pushes us to empty out and disperse like an empty cloud, right? And when we do that, we begin to feel everything around us as part of ourselves. And it's this beautiful, beautiful state. I would say it's worth any price. You know, I love that experience. And now that's actually reality from the Buddhist standpoint, right? That's really reality. The isolation of the self is a fantasy, and it's a prison, right? It's not protective, it's a prison. But when we realize that, you know, we're not an independent organism, but we're part of this bigger system, right? You know, it requires trust. I guess that's the way to put it. You know, it's easy to imagine we control our lives. But the more we are aware of our interdependence, the more we have to, like, cultivate trust. And when we cultivate trust, you know, our fear goes away. You know, so, you know, I think that the idea that we have, like, personal power or personal strength, or I think that's a fantasy, right? You know, none of us could live for, you know, basically a couple minutes without oxygen, right? I mean, we have this fantasy of ourselves as, quote, individuals, right? But the Diamond Sutra says isolated individuals. But, you know, actually, every time we feel our powerlessness, that's also a way of feeling our dependency on other people. And, you know, dependency, feeling dependent on other people is actually not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. You know, I think all human relationships come out of that experience of helplessness and dependency. You know, when I was, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was a little boy, one of the things I enjoyed most was if I fell down. I remember once I broke my arm. I was playing around with my brother, and he threw a sock at me on the wax floor, and I lost my footing and I broke my arm. And it, I have to say, it really hurt. I broke it, I don't know how I broke it, in several places, but I was, and my mother, I went over to my mother, and I remember she put her arms around me, you know, and it was so nice. I can still remember it, you know. The pain didn't exactly go away, but I felt like, oh, I'm safe. Right? I'm safe. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we do zazen, you know, we get to that place where I think it's like the universe puts its arms around us and we feel safe. And, you know, I don't think that's an illusion. I think the universe has its arms around us, right? I mean, sickness, old age, and death are inevitable. Inevitable. You know, at some point, you know, you're not going to be able to lift weights anymore, right? You know, if that's how you're not going to be able to run. Someday I'm not going to be able to run 5 miles, you know, or maybe I'll be able to run 5 miles in 2 hours or something like that, you know. But that day is going to come. And, you know, I'm practicing right now being helpless, you know, and I actually enjoy it, you know. I don't know if you ever had this experience, but, you know, I don't like to use my phone for directions when I'm in New York. Sometimes I'll do it, but I first of all, I like to know the city. I like to have a map in my head, right? At least Manhattan. And I enjoy asking people for directions when I'm lost, you know? You know, being lost is an interesting experience, right? You know, it's like, I'm lost. I've been in many times, I don't know Manhattan that well, but, you know, sometimes I'll be in places I thought I knew and I'll be totally lost and I can't see anything. If you can see the Empire State Building, you're fine, right? But I can't see anything and I'll say, you know, how do I get to this or where am I, you know? And they'll, you know, New Yorkers are actually, on the whole, rather friendly people. They'll give you directions, and I'll say, is there a good place to get a cup of coffee around here? And it's so nice to be helped. That's really wonderful. It's wonderful to be helped. Yeah, and maybe it's hard to accept help, right? It's hard to accept help sometimes. I can do it myself. But I so enjoy being helped. And part of it is that, you know, people are giving me a gift, right? And when I accept a gift, it's not really any more about finding a good coffee shop. It's like, I'm really asking this person, who are you? You know, what's your life like? And people start talking about something. Sometimes people are laughing or I'm laughing and they'll tell me, yo, you wouldn't believe this place. You know, there's a jazz club or something like that. And it's like, no kidding. You know, I'll have to come back. I never come back, but it's wonderful to be helpless sometime, right? And of course it's wonderful to help, right? It's a number one thing in the world, I think, number one thing is to be helpless and to be helped. That's the best thing in the world, yeah. And I think number two is to be healthy, right? So somebody's crying and you go over and you put your arms around them and you say, I'm so sorry, how can I help you? And this is like giving a gift. And both of those people are lifted out of their isolation, right? And connected to a bigger world. So we're all disabled, right? Without oxygen, we're not going to make it. You know, I didn't grow my own food today. You know, no matter how strong you are, you need help, right? So we're all disabled. We're all people of disabilities. But our disabilities are like the door into this deeper connectedness, right? I have a metabolic disorder, you know. If I don't take a pill, in about 6 months, my kidneys will fail, right? And if I take this pill, I can live to be 90. I could live to be 100, right? It's great, you know. My life depends on like this little pill, basically. You know, some guy invented that. I don't even know who. I'm so grateful. You know, so I can run 5 miles, but if I don't get that pill, I am going to die. But we're all in that situation. We're all in that situation all the time. You know, we're all just a breath away from not being alive, and we don't control it. We don't make it happen. You know, everything is a gift. Our lives are a gift, you know. And you know, we're utterly helpless, actually. And we're in the arms of the world, you know. And it's like, what a beautiful It's hard for humans to appreciate, right? But we sit down on the cushion after half a day of zazen, it's like, oh, gratitude. You know, thank you for this life. Thank you for this beautiful life.